Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
So the right to stay home actually includes both of these rights. It includes the right to an alternative to being forced into migration, but it also means that if you do decide to leave home and to work as a migrant in another country, you have a right to social equality. You have some political rights. You have economic rights.
That's the voice of David Bacon. On this week's show, we speak to David about his latest book, The Right to Stay Home, How U.S. Policy Drives Mexican Migration. So stay tuned.
We're very privileged to be joined by author David Bacon. He is the author of Illegal People, How Globalization Creates Migration and Criminalizes Immigrants. Welcome to our show, David.
Hi, Sylvia.
So great to hear your voice. Now, we are looking at a world that is, filled with struggle. Wherever we look, whether it's Greece, Spain, Latin America, we see people rising against the capitalist system. And we often are presented with very limited options, either austerity or economic collapse. What is the story that is missing from this very narrow perspective of how the world is organized and how the world can function?
Well, I think that the reason why there's such an enormous push for austerity is because we still live in a world that does not look that different from the old colonial world when the U.S., European countries, Japan, divided up the world and then proceeded to basically take the wealth that was in the countries that were the colonies and bring it to the metropolitan countries. So, and that has enormous consequences. And what I'm thinking about, Sylvia, is the recent publicity that we've seen in the media about the deaths of people in Europe, the people who are especially crossing the Mediterranean, trying to reach Lampedusa and Sicily, and also people who are now traveling overland through Turkey and then into Greece and then up through the Balkans into Western Europe. Part of the reason why people are coming is because of the wars that are devastating countries like Syria, many of the countries of North Africa. But these wars are themselves the product of trying to maintain an unjust world order. In other words, if we look at Libya, for instance, I think that the intervention in Libya that led to the downfall of Muammar Gaddafi, now looking for the moment at what kind of regime he had in Libya, but the main reason for the intervention was to essentially expropriate and continue to expropriate the oil in Libya. And as a result of that, Libya has turned into a country that is very violent, one in which there are different armed groups fighting each other, and the oil in Libya is going to wind up back in the hands of large corporations. So the purpose of the intervention really was to capture and maintain control of that oil, in other words, the natural resources. And when you look throughout Africa and the Middle East, you see the same kind of thing going on. You know, the oil of Nigeria winds up coming to Europe. The profits from the sale of it stay in Europe. They don't go back to Nigeria, at least not a lot of them. And Nigerians, in the meantime, are forced into migration to Europe, and so you find people who are, selling knockoff handbags in the plazas and the streets of Rome because they can't make a living at home. So the consequences of the sort of the ripoff of the resources of Africa is, that the people of those countries can't really make a living there and wind up coming to the countries that were their original colonizers. And then the wars that get fought to ensure that this situation doesn't change also produce an enormous amount of displacement. You know, we have millions of people who have been leaving Iraq and leaving Syria, and these are really wars that are fought in order to make sure that Western Europe, the United States, continue to kind of occupy the dominant positions in an economic world order.
You know, when you talk about not only the implications of maintaining a system that is so inequitable and unjust, you know, that produces so much suffering and so much violence, in many ways, the violence is both the military intervention, but it's also the economic warfare against the working class. Can we talk a little bit about the numbers of immigrants that this policy of globalization, and to me it's neoliberalism really, because globalization, the world, there's always been people, you know, mobilizing on the global scale, but this liberalization of capital and this idea of companies having the right to impose practices that devalue workers' productivity, that devalue the worth of what, you know, one worker produces in one area and poses them against another worker, say Mexico and Canada, for instance. So I wonder if you could maybe talk a little bit about the relationships that create, that are maintaining, how are these relationships not only naturalize the violence against the people, but also the double edge of criminalization of the workers who, who escape those conditions and come to the U.S. or Europe?
Well, first of all, in terms of just the numbers, the number of people who are living outside the countries where they were born, according to the UNHCR, the UN High Commission on Refugees, is about 300 million people in the world today. But I think that's really actually a pretty gross underestimate. And it also doesn't really take into account the internal migration. In other words, people who are displaced and forced to leave home but don't necessarily cross borders. You know, there are, for instance, hundreds of millions of people in China who are migrating from the countryside in China to the cities, essentially because of the difference in the standard of living in China between the countryside and the cities. And so this is a migration, in other words, economic migration as well, too. I think that this was recently highlighted by President Obama, who went to visit the homeland of his father, Kenya, on his recent trip to Africa, and, you know, talked about the need for modernizing the economies of Africa, and then especially of Eastern Africa and Kenya. The reality is that just 3 years ago, Kenya was presented with what was called an economic partnership agreement between Kenya and the European Union. And essentially, this agreement would have allowed large European corporations to operate freely in Kenya. In other words, to dump manufactured goods, for instance, on the market in Kenya and prevent the growth of a native industry in Kenya itself, as well as to hold down the prices of agricultural goods and to serve as sort of like a dumping ground for surplus agricultural products from Europe. So Kenya originally refused to sign that agreement and then was told by European countries that they would impose extremely high tariffs and other customs duties on its exports to Europe. And the economy of Kenya, like most developing countries, has become dependent on markets now in wealthy countries. So that was a very, very powerful threat to make. And eventually the Kenyan government surrendered and signed that agreement. And that's no, you know, in no coincidence, you know, Kenyans are arriving in Europe and in even in the United States today as migrants, essentially for economic reasons. So again, you know, this is the sort of the shaping of the economies of developing countries for the interests of, you know, large corporations, with the governments of, you know, the United States and European governments, and Canada does the same thing, especially under under Harper these days, has essentially the same policy you know, Canadian mining companies, for instance, are the main mining companies operating now in Mexico and in Central America, causing enormous environmental devastation to rural communities and, again, resulting in the displacement of people. So what happens to people when they become displaced in this way is they then become part of the workforce in wealthy countries and developed countries, Europe, United States, Canada, Japan, and so forth. And that workforce, the place where they enter the workforce is at the bottom. In other words, they become some of the lowest paid workers working in some of the most dangerous and unpleasant conditions. And this kind of position that immigrant workers find themselves in is reinforced by the lack of legal status for many of those migrants. You know, in the United States, we have probably about 12 million people here who don't have any kind of legal status. What that means is that it's easy for employers to threaten people and to tell people that, you know, if they don't work an extra hour of overtime without getting overtime pay, that the employer will fire them because of their immigration status, which is happening quite a lot. And even worse than that, people can wind up becoming deportable. And we also have programs that bring people from those countries to metropolitan countries as low-wage labor. Canada and the United States both have large guest worker programs, which essentially treat people who are coming to Canada and the U.S. as being workers who are going to work for wages that are at the bottom, people who don't acquire the right to live permanently in either of these two countries, and who basically have a kind of a social and political status which excludes them from the rights and the protections that other workers have. So this is a very conscious effort, essentially, to channel the people who are being displaced, in other words, people who can't really survive in their countries of origin, into places in the economies of wealthy countries where their labor can be put to good use and at a very low pay.
You know, I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that, because, I mean, many Canadians and a lot of Americans, I presume, also. But when you talk to workers, they say, you know, boy, it makes sense that a worker should come here with a visa, a working visa. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this, the significance of this policy that invites workers as so-called guest workers, and the implication that this has for labor organizations in Canada and the U.S., because it is a double sword for the immigrants. You know, as I've experienced, many of the immigrants are told they're welcome to come here, but that so-called guest working visa also indicates a kind of double-tier system for workers. And I wonder if you could maybe touch on the significance for our labor movements in North America and why it's important for us to not only acknowledge the inequalities that cause people to be displaced, to cause people to leave their countries of origin and face such marginal and unsafe conditions.
The key question to look at here is, you know, what the conditions of the visa are. In other words, what kind of rights does do visa holders have? Up there in Vancouver, there's a very important organization, Justicia for Migrant Workers, which for a long time has said that the people who are arriving in Canada on guest worker visas should be given the right to stay in Canada, to have their families with them, to basically live in a kind of social status that is the same as anybody else in Canada. And there are organizations like the Frente Indígena de Organizaciones Binacionales in the United States that advocates for the same kind of thing here. The problem with the guest worker visa is that essentially what it does is it does two things. First of all, it sets up a system in which employers go and recruit workers in their countries of origin. And as they say, you know, who pays the musicians, you know, calls the tune. So, in other words, that if people are brought to the U.S. or to Canada by employers, those employers bring them with the expectation, and not just the expectation, but with the legal requirement that the people that they bring work for them. So, in other words, it's not a free situation in which people can kind of look for a job and find one wherever they want, you know, and looking essentially for the best-paying job. These are workers who then are brought to Canada and the U.S. and who are held in that kind of employment status in which their wages are at the bottom. They're temporary arrangements. In other words, you don't have the right to stay in Canada. You don't have the right to stay in the United States. When your work contract is up, you have to leave. And if you lose your job, if your employer decides to fire you, for instance, because you join a union, which has happened in nurseries and greenhouses in Ambie, then you lose your ability to stay. You lose your visa. So that's why they're called work visas, is because your ability to stay in the country is connected to your work and to your job. The other kind of visa is one that allows people to become permanent residents. In other words, that says that even though you're not a citizen, you can live in Canada and the United States. You can live where you want. You can work or you cannot work as you want. You can work wherever you want. And you have the same rights to join unions. You can fight for higher wages. There are still some restrictions in the United States, especially because people not having citizenship status, they can't vote, which is a very big problem for us because in certain areas of the United States, we have many, many, many thousands of workers who are not citizens and who can't vote. And consequently, the political structure, the areas where people are living is dominated by their employers rather than by workers themselves. I'm thinking especially of the rural areas in California here. Nevertheless, a permanent residence visa, what the United States is called the green card, is a kind of visa that gives people rights that a work visa and a guest worker does not. That's why employers like guest worker programs. In fact, that's why there's a big push on in both of our countries to expand these programs and to bring more and more workers. They are especially problematic for unions because what happens essentially is that when workers in the country on guest worker visas get upset and decide that they don't like the wages that they are being paid and decide that they want to organize a union like the United Food and Commercial Workers, which has organized some of the greenhouses and nurseries in British Columbia, employers fire those workers and then proceed to deport them with the help of the Mexican consulate. In other words, the Mexican consulate will go to guest workers and say, you know, don't go out on strike. Don't cause problems. You know, don't speak out, because if you do that, you're going to make these programs much less attractive to the Canadian government and to Canadian employers. And so that's a big problem for unions, because what it really means is that you have a workforce that is very fearful of the risks that are involved in organizing because of what conceivably can happen to people.
David, we've been talking about the impact that globalization has had and how this deepening of poverty not only forces people to migrate, but the kind of insecurity that this creates for workers worldwide. Can we talk a little bit about your book, The Right to Stay Home? What inspired you to write this book?
Well, the reason why it's called The Right to Stay Home, Sylvia, is because there is a growing movement. Well, in the case of this book, what I'm especially looking at is Mexico and especially the state of Oaxaca. But this movement exists in other countries as well, too, especially, for instance, the Philippines and some others, in which people are saying, first of all, that they want to have an alternative to being forced into migration because of the lack of any other way for families and for communities to survive economically. So in Oaxaca, for instance, people were very, very strongly affected by the North American Free Trade Agreement because it allowed U.S. corporations to dump corn on the Mexican market at such a low price that it essentially made it impossible for farmers in Oaxaca to grow corn and sell it for a price that would pay for the cost of growing it. And the big irony, of course, is that corn cultivation started in Oaxaca thousands of years ago. So here we are forcing off of the land people who were responsible for the fact that we're able to eat corn to begin with. But in those communities, people are saying, well, that something has to change here, that this system is not a fair and a just system, that people should be able to grow up and live and have a decent life in Oaxaca, which means in this case that there would have to be higher prices for agricultural products. It would mean restricting foreign corporations. It would mean getting rid of the North American Free Trade Agreement. But people are also saying that, you know, they need the same basic things that all working people need: good schools, a healthcare system, jobs, and so forth. And in order to get those in Oaxaca, people need political change. So the movements that are talking about this, like the Frente Indígena, are also movements that are calling for political change. You could say that the Zapatistas were calling for the same thing when they rose up in rebellion in Chiapas in 1994. So the right to stay home really means the right for an alternative to forced migration. Now, we're talking about communities that are very dependent on migration, because the world has advanced quite a bit from the time when people first started leaving their homes in Oaxaca looking for some other way of earning a living. So you have communities in Oaxaca in which many, many, many family members are already working in the United States and in Canada, for that matter. And so the right to stay home is also goes along with the rights of migrants. So these communities are saying that if we leave home, we have a right to be treated with dignity and respect in the countries that we go to and work. We have the right to make a decent wage. We have the right to join a union. We have a right not to be deported or to be thrown into some kind of detention center. But we also have the right to decide whether or not we want to migrate to begin with. In other words, migration should be a voluntary process and not one that's forced on people. So the right to stay home actually includes both of these rights. It includes the right to an alternative to being forced into migration, but it also means that if you do decide to leave home and to work as a migrant in another country, you have a right to social equality. You have some political rights. You have economic rights. So this is really, I think, not exactly a new way of looking at migration, but it's one that I think is a very humanistic way of looking at migration. This is a sort of a point of view that is arising from people themselves and solutions that are being voiced by those communities that are most involved in the system of migration as it is in the world today.
I also think that it's important to note that while the struggle today seems to be one that it's an uphill, you know, mode, right? When we look at Greece, when we look at Latin America, when we look at many of the economic coups that are happening worldwide, it would seem that our struggles are perhaps unfruitful. But I think your book reflects that this growing movement, it's an exemplary of how connected we all are, you know, as workers, as people worldwide, in this ideal of a world with justice, a world with dignity. And I think if there is one concept that perhaps embraces the work that you do, is that of dignity, that every human being has inherent value and that we all do better, you know, when we all treat each other with that dignity, with that, you know, inherent value. How can people access your work? How can people get involved and become catalysts of social change in our communities?
United Food Commercial Workers in Canada and British Columbia is very much involved in organizing helping immigrant workers to organize unions. So that's one way. And then right across the border, there's a big organizing effort, including a number of strikes that have taken place this year in Bellingham, near Bellingham, by Oaxacan migrant workers at a ranch called Sukuma Farms. And they set up an independent union called Familias Unidas por la Justicia, and they're calling for a boycott of Driscoll Berries because Driscoll is the corporation that's responsible for the problems that they're facing at work. So that's another way that you can help as well, too.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is David Bacon. He is a beautiful writer, and his books are amazing. His latest book, The Right to Stay Home, How U.S. Policy Drives Mexican Migration. Thank you so much for being with us. And give us your website once more so people know how to access your books.
Sure. It's like my name, dbacon@igc.org.
Thank you again. We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.